We're going to get started. Always a pleasure to welcome back Julie, who I last saw on our wonderful trip in Israel, our live trip in Israel a couple of days, the end of December. And then now we're back. Baruch Hashem, tourism is picking up a little bit. So I think Julie's a little busier than she was a couple of years ago, which is good. But now we're excited to have her back. This is going to be, I think, a five-part series, really, until Pesach. 2 weeks there won't be class because it'll be Erev Purim. At least in Israel, it'll be Purim already. And okay, we're going to start with Ein Karim. Bakasha, Shuli, it's all yours.
Okay, thank you so much. Nice to be back. Yes, so we are kind of in between Tu B'Shvat and Pesach. We're going to do five classes on different neighborhoods in Yerushalayim. Last time, our last series that we did, we were in mostly in the Old City, a little bit outside. We did Harazetim. This time, we are going to be in the New City, and we're going to be exploring neighborhoods that are maybe a little bit less well-known, and we're going to start with a neighborhood that, you know, it's very nice to do these Zoom tours, but this is really a place at this time of year is spectacular to see in person, and that is Ein Karim. And as you can see, this picture is taken. I don't know exactly when it was taken, but clearly it's around this time of year, springtime. Ein Karim down in the valley. The valley is part of Nachal Sorek. The Sorek Valley is filled with almond trees, and now is the time they are blossoming, and in general, Israel is just so beautiful this time of year. But Ein Karim, we are talking about as a neighborhood that is the country in the city. Okay, Ein Karim, people who have been to Jerusalem many, many times. I have never been to this neighborhood. On the western edge of Jerusalem, it used to be outside of the city, but it definitely still feels like it is not in the city. And it has a feeling of countryside. Today, it is within the municipal boundaries of the city, but it goes back very, very far back, goes back to Canaanite times, and we're going to try to explore and understand a little more about what is Ein Karim and what happens there. So let's get started right away with where we are, okay? So first of all, that's always very important to understand where we are when we talk about neighborhoods, right? So let's just locate ourselves as always, right? The core of Jerusalem, the original Jerusalem, is the Old City, right? So the Old City is all the way over here. We don't have it so nicely delineated, but basically over here in the east, Ein Karim is to the west, a little bit to the south, mostly to the west. If you want to kind of locate yourself in terms of landmarks that you might be familiar with in Jerusalem, Mount Herzl, okay, the area of the military cemetery, right next door to it is Yad Vashem, Shaarei Tzedek, right? We are in the western part of the city, the Knesset, Hebrew University, right? Very busy these days, actually, right now, okay? But in ancient times, this is outside the city. An important thing to understand, and we're going to reflect on this in other places that we go to, okay, when the city of Jerusalem is just the Old City, right, which is really up until pretty much the 19th century, with a couple of exceptions here and there, you have two rings around the city, okay? The first ring, the closer ring, is a ring of graves, because Jews and others as well do not bury in the city. So you're not going to bury in the city, but you're not going to go so far outside the city. So in the areas outside the city, the Kidron Valley, the Hinnom Valley, to the north, Derech Shechem, right? That's where you're going to find lots of burial caves. But then there's a second ring that goes further out, and that is a ring of farms, okay, farming villages. And Ein Karim is part of that story. Ein Karim, Ramat Rachel, Gilo, the area of Binyan Alma, Har HaTzofim, these are all areas that in ancient times were farming villages for a very easy to understand reason. Okay? The city of Jerusalem, the Old City, has no room for agriculture. Not only that, but if you look at the Mishnah, you're not supposed to grow things in Jerusalem. You're not supposed to raise animals in Jerusalem. Jerusalem is a holy city. It's a city that is connected to the Mikdash and the Kohanim. You're not supposed to have farms there, and there's practically not a simple way to have them. There's not enough room. But you have a great need for agriculture, right? both for produce, right? Grapes to make wine, olives to make oil, also animals for the sacrifices. You need this for the mikdash, for the temple. You need it for the residents, and you need it for the huge number of pilgrims, of Ole Regel, who are traveling to Jerusalem, who are increasing the size of the city at least three times a year, if not more than that. So you're always going to need this agricultural kind of backup. And that's why in all the hills around Jerusalem, and that's why you have all, you can take advantage of all these nice springs that we have around Jerusalem. You have agricultural villages where you are bringing your produce to Jerusalem to be used there, certainly in the time of the temple. Afterwards as well, right? Even when Jerusalem is no longer a city that's controlled by Jews, you have a Roman city, a Byzantine city, Crusader, Muslim. The city is still the important place, but it's not an agricultural place, and you need farms that are going to supply the city. Okay, so that's just to understand a little bit of where we are. And Karem also is in the area of what we'll call the Judean Hills, Hare Yehuda, right, which is the mountains. We usually think of it as the mountains that are kind of outside the city, on the road, the Jerusalem-Tel Aviv highway, right? You have terraces, you have farms, you have a lot of springs. And the springs, the water, is what's going to be the life of the city, okay? So we're going to come back to that. Ein Karim itself today, the neighborhood of Ein Karim, at the end of the Zoom, we're going to get to Hadassah Ein Karim, which is near Ein Karim, right? You can see it in the Google map here, right? It's right over here. But right now, we're not talking about the hospital, which is kind of up on a hill. We're talking about the neighborhood, which is down in the valley. Okay. And we are going to be visiting virtually a few places. The most important place, of course, is the spring that gives Ein Karim its name, right? What is the word Ein Karim? Ein, Ayin, Mayan, a spring, right? Spring, Karim, we'll get to the Karim in a minute, but clearly there's some connection to grapes, to vineyards, to wine. Okay. So this is the core. You see, it's called Mary Spring here because there's a very important Christian story in general. People who know a little bit about Jerusalem, you say to them Ein Karim, they'll say, oh, it's very Christian, right? And you can see there are quite a number of churches here, right? We have the Church of the Visitation, the Sisters of Zion, the Church of John the Baptist, which is not marked on this map, but it's here. Okay. You have a lot of different churches that are around, and there is a lot of Christian significance to Ein Karim, and we'll talk about why. But before that, and really because this is the case, it was important to Christians. This was a Jewish village because the beginnings of Christianity, of course, is in Judaism. So this is a Jewish village, and all the life is around the spring. And we are going to be going around and seeing various places, including the Sisters of Zion, the Church of the Visitation, John the Baptist, the spring, the mountain, Mount Ora, which is all the way out here, right? Not so clear in our picture. Those are the various places we are going to see. Okay, let's understand. Somebody wrote here, problem is with sound? No, or is this just one person? Everybody's hearing okay? Thumbs up if yes or
we
not.
We hear fine, I think.
Okay.
Sound is good in Baltimore.
Good. Okay. All right. Let's continue. So let's take a look at our timeline. Always important. Okay. So Ein Karim goes back. There were excavations, we'll see, that were done in Ein Karim by the Franciscans, by the Catholic Church, that revealed that the village goes back already pre-biblical times, right? It goes back to the late Bronze Age, to the time before, not pre-biblical, but the time before Am Yisrael come into the land with Yoshua. Okay, it's a Canaanite village. Then it's conquered by the Jews, and in First Temple times, it's an Israelite village. We'll talk about what its name is. We'll get to that, okay? Second Temple times, it is a Judean town, like we said, the outskirts of the city, this agricultural town. It gains in importance for Christians when the Empress Helena, the mother of Emperor Constantine, who converts the Roman Empire to Christianity, she establishes churches in Ein Karim, and that gives Ein Karim its Christian significance because of a story that she attributes to taking place in Ein Karim. Okay? And then we have the usual dance that we have in Eretz Yisrael in most places, right? The Muslims come. They get rid of the church. The Christians come, they get rid of the mosques. The Muslims come back, they get rid of the Christians, Muslims, Christians, Muslims, Christians, back and forth. Finally, in the 17th century, even though the Ottomans, the Muslims, are in charge, the Franciscan Catholics are allowed to come back to settle in Ankarim, to rebuild some of the churches. And in the 19th century, you have another influx of more Christians who are coming. In the 20th century, a few Jews, but very few. And by 1929, no Jews. But until 1948, Ankarim is a large village, a large Arab village, Muslims and Christians. When the IDF conquers Ankarim in July of 1948, the Arabs, the Muslims all flee, as we're going to see, except for very, very few exceptions. The Christians, the monks and the nuns stay around, but majority of the village is emptied out. And you have the next stage, which is these new immigrants, right? We have that huge influx of immigration in the first few years of Israel's existence. Where are you going to put them? Some of them are put in abandoned Arab neighborhoods like Ankarim. Rachel Yanait Ben Tzvi comes along and builds a youth village here, right? We'll come back to all these things. I just wanted to have a basic understanding of the timeline. And in 1961, Hadassah Ankarim is built on the hill above the village of Ankarim. Okay, so that's just to give us a larger picture. Now let's go back and take a deeper look. Okay, so we have some excavations that were done by the Franciscan monks who are very involved in archaeology. We're going to come back to them and how they dig by John the Baptist. But the earlier excavations that they did, the earlier stuff that they found, right? They found Canaanite grave. They found pottery. They found remains of Roman temple. We'll come back to that, right? This is a very, very fertile place. Okay? It's a great place to grow all sorts of things. Could it be a place that focuses only on wine, right? So the name, what is the name in Tanakh times? The name since medieval times, for sure, is Ankarim. Karim, Kerem, same word, right? We also have the nice connection of the valley below. Okay, the valley below is part of the very, very important valley. It's called the Sorek Valley, Nahal Sorek, Wadi Sorek. Okay, very, very important. It is one of the deep riverbeds that takes the water out to the Mediterranean, right? We're on the watershed. If you go, if the water falls to the west, it goes to the Mediterranean, falls to the east, it goes to the Dead Sea. Here it goes out to the Mediterranean through the Sorek Valley. Sorek is another clue. What is Sorek? Sorek is another word for grapevines. Okay. We hear the blessing for Yehuda, right? Jacob's blessing. Osrei la gefen iro ulisorka bene atono. He ties, he has so many grapevines, Yehuda. We know the area of Judah has a lot of vineyards. He has so many grapevines that he ties his donkey to the grapevines, right? Osrei la gefen. We know what gefen means. It's a verse that has two parallel parts. So if we have the donkey tied up to the gefen in part one, ulisorka bene atono, right? He ties up to the sorek, his donkey. Sorek, gefen, kerem, it all is the same thing. This is a village that focuses on growing grapes and making wine. Now, do we have a name of such a place in Tanakh? So in Tanakh, we hear twice about a place named not Ankarim, but Beit HaKerem, okay? The house of the vineyard, okay? Where do we hear about it? Well, we hear about it. You have the second verse here. In the book of Nehemiah, right? Shivat Zion, the Jews come back, at the end, temple is destroyed. They're in Babylonia. The Persians conquer. They allow the Jews to come back. And when they come back, everything has been destroyed. They need to repair the walls around Jerusalem. And different people are responsible for different parts. Who's responsible for the area of Shar HaAshpot, of the Dung Gate? Malchia ben Rechav, Sar Pelech, Beit HaKerem. Malchia, the son of Rechav, the chief of the district of Beit HaKerem. So we know already in the time of Ezra Nehemiah, there is a Beit HaKerem. Is it here? We don't know. But we have this fabulous pasuk in the book of Jeremiah and Yirmiyahu. Okay, take a look. Yirmiyahu Perek Vav, Yirmiyahu, the sixth chapter, he's warning the people about danger that is coming from the north, right? We have another very famous pasuk, Mitzafon Tipatach Ra'ah. The evil is going to come from the north. Here it says, Ra'ah Nishkefa Mitzafon. The evil is coming, is appearing from the north, or is looking out from the north. Why the north? Number one, Babylonia, they're coming from the north. Number two, the north is the most vulnerable part of Jerusalem, doesn't have valleys to protect it. But listen to who he calls out to protect him, right? He says, get ready, get ready. Who should get ready? Hey, Ezu b'nei Binyamin mikerev Yerushalayim. Flee for refuge, people of Benjamin. Ubit ka'atik u'shofar, right? Very nice alliteration. Blow a shofar into ka'ah. Ba'al Beit HaKerem Se'u Mas'et. What is Yirmiyahu doing? What he's doing is he's calling out to the people in various areas around the city. So let's go piece by piece. Binyamin, very nice. Where's Binyamin? Binyamin is to the north of Jerusalem. That's easy, right? We got rid of the north. Tekoa, where's Tekoa? Tekoa is out towards the Dead Sea, the edge of the desert. It's to the east. It's also to the south, right? So the east and the south. So far we've gotten north, we've gotten east, or maybe south. So what's left? West, or maybe south, right? So Beit HaKerem could be west, or it could be south. Where are we? We are in Ein Karem. We are to the west of the city. Beautiful, right? But we have another place that we suggest is maybe Beit HaKerem, and that's Ramat Rachel here in the south. So it could be either. A lot of people think that because of the same name that we've retained that name of Karem, Karem, right? And this Pasuk that we are talking about, the biblical Beit HaKerem. Okay, so that's a suggestion. But that's all we know about Beit HaKerem. Not so much, but enough to know that it existed in the time of Tanakh. Now, the story that makes Ein Karem famous actually does not mention Ein Karem at all. And this is a story in the New Testament. And it's a story about a couple named Zechariah and Elisheba, or as her name is translated into Greek and then to English, Elizabeth. Right? Now, this is a Jewish couple, obviously. This is a story in the New Testament in the book of Luke. Right? And we have this Jewish couple. He's a Kohen. She's also a Kohen, right? She's a descendant of Kohanim. So they're this very holy couple. And here we have a trope that we are very familiar with. In the time of Herod, king of Judea, there was a priest named Zechariah who belonged to the priestly division of Aviah. His wife, Elizabeth, was also a descendant of Aaron. Both of them were righteous, observing all the Lord's commandments, but they were childless. Okay, we know this story. We've heard it many, many times, right? Abraham and Sarah, Yaakov and Rachel, right? So many different people in Tanakh are childless. The New Testament often takes themes that we have in Tanakh and uses them. Okay, and we're going to see there's a couple of themes here. So what happens with childless couples in Tanakh? They get, somebody appears to them, a prophet or God, and says, you're going to have a baby. And that's what happens here. Zechariah is in the temple. He's on duty. He's serving as a priest. He goes in. He brings in the incense. Go down here to the third paragraph. An angel of the Lord appeared to him standing at the right side of the altar. When Zechariah saw him, he was startled. But the angel said, don't be afraid, Zechariah. Your prayer has been heard. Your wife will bear you a son. You are to call him John. Now listen to what's supposed to happen to John. He will be great in the sight of the Lord. He is never to take wine or other fermented drinks. And he will be filled with the Holy Spirit even before he is born. Aha. Second familiar theme. He is going to be a Nazir from birth, just like Shimshon, just like Shmuel, right? He is going to be a Nazir. So we have another theme that we have. And here we have, and now we have a third theme. He will bring back many of the people of Israel to the Lord their God, and he will go before the Lord in the spirit and power of Elijah to turn the hearts of the parents to their children. Here it's not just stealing a theme, it's stealing the actual verse. And the disobedient to the wisdom of the righteous, right? The end of Malachi, the parents will go to the children will return to the parents. Okay, so this guy is going to be a prophet, he's going to be a Nazir, he's going to bring people back to do tshuva. But where's our connection to Ein Karem? So far we're in the temple, we're hearing from Zechariah. Then Elizabeth gets pregnant, and that's where we have the character that is very familiar, Mary. Mary's also pregnant, and she has a cousin, and her cousin is Elizabeth Elisheba. At that time, Mary got ready and hurried to a town in the hill country of Judea. Notice it does not say Ein Karim or Beit HaKarim. It's a town in the hill country of Judea, which we've said could be many, many places, where she entered Zechariah's home and greeted Elizabeth. Now, these are two pregnant women. Okay, Elizabeth is carrying John, who is going to become John the Baptist. Okay, Mary is carrying a baby who's going to be, of course, Jesus. What happens when Elizabeth heard Mary's greeting? The baby leaped in her womb, and Elizabeth was filled with the Holy Spirit. In a loud voice, she exclaimed, "Blessed are you among women. Blessed is the child you will bear." Right? What's happening? Baby John, the fetus, is excited about the fetus baby Jesus, because he is a harbinger. He is a mivaser, just like Eliyahu Lahavdil is going to tell us that the Messiah is coming. John is the Eliyahu for Jesus. Okay. And that's what's going on in the story. Now, it's a nice story, despite its cribbing from Tanakh. But where do we have Ein Karim? Okay, we don't have Ein Karim. We don't even have a spring. Okay, but we're going to see, we'll come back to it in a few minutes, that when the Empress Helena comes to the land of Israel in the 4th century, she knows the story, and she decides that the story must take place not only in Ein Karim, but at the spring. Because where do people meet in Tanakh? They meet at the spring. They meet at the well. They meet where the water is. Okay, so she connects these two things, the spring and the town of Ein Karim, to the story. But let's digress from the Christians for a moment and talk about the spring. Okay, so if you've done any traveling, any hiking around Yerushalayim, you know that there are many, many springs in Yerushalayim. They are what are called layered springs, okay, where, see it here, we'll come back, but you have a layered spring, which means that the water, rain comes down, it goes into the mountain, it goes, it looks for a place to come out, right? As soon as it finds a place to come out, an opening in the rocks, it pours out, and that's very useful for anybody who wants to have a village, agriculture, anything else. In order to make the spring more useful, what people did in ancient times is they dug out a channel, right? They dug a tunnel that went to the source and kind of widened it so that you would get more water. And that's what you see here in Ein Karim by the spring that has come to be known as Mary's Spring. You artificially open it up so you have more water. And this is a spring that is still flowing today. And in fact, up until not so long ago, right, up until pretty much before 1948, there wasn't, so the British bring water to Jerusalem, but there still were droughts in Jerusalem. And certainly when there was the siege on Jerusalem, there wasn't enough water. But before the British have brought water to Jerusalem, there's not so much water in Jerusalem, right? You have the Gihon spring in the old city. That's it. So what would the Arabs in the village of Ein Karim do? They would, in the summer when your cisterns ran dry and there wasn't enough water, fill up jugs with water, bring them on their donkeys to the city, and people would buy water. So this is a water source that remained important up until relatively recently. Now, just a little short digression. Terraces is a nice snowy picture. Okay. We're talking about agriculture. Okay. If you are traveling around Jerusalem, or if you come out towards Gush Etzion, you can see it in lots of places in Israel. You will see what are called terraces, right? Terraces, these nice steps. There's such a thing in the Far East, but in the Middle East, terraces are an invention that go back to Am Yisrael, right? Today, most of the terraces that you see are built by Arabs. They're actually built really, really well. So you can have terraces that are on the road from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv that haven't been maintained since 1948, because the Arab villages are almost all completely gone from there, but they're still in good shape because they're built very, very, very well. So the Arabs are the ones who really do them in recent times, but they go back to the time of Yahushua. Why? Because when the Jews come into the land with Joshua, the good agricultural land, the lowlands, the Shvelah, is taken by the Canaanites. The less good but still okay land by the coast, taken by the Philistines. What's left for us, for Am Yisrael? What's left is the mountains. Mountains are not so good for agriculture, right? You have erosion. You lose all your good soil. So what do they come up with? They come up with this idea of making steps, of making terraces, which means you have A, more space, and B, the soil, the good soil doesn't all get washed away. So terraces you can see all around Hare Yerushalayim and also in the area of Ein Karim. But let's go back to our historical story. Okay. Along comes the Empress Helena. Right? She is the mother of the Emperor Constantine. Right? Constantine is a Roman emperor who has a vision, who has an epiphany, and he converts to Christianity. He establishes the city of Constantinople, named after him. Okay? And he doesn't just have a private conversion. He brings all Roman Empire along with him because he's an emperor. Okay? His mother is maybe even more devout than him. And she takes a trip to the Holy Land in the year 326 of the Common Era. And what she does when she comes here is she essentially creates the most important Christian holy places. I don't say create in the sense that she made it up out of whole cloth. I don't think she did. I think there were very, very strong traditions that she was following. The most significant place that she founds is what you see here in the picture on the right, and that's the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, where she decides, based on the evidence that's presented to her, that this is the place of the crucifixion and the burial of Jesus, and therefore it has to become an incredibly important shrine. But not only here, she establishes the Church of the Nativity in Beit Lechem, and she comes to Ein Karim and she says, this is the place of the story of Mary and Elizabeth. And she makes two churches here. Okay, one is the Church of the Visitation, okay, which is supposed to be the house of Zechariah and Elisheva. And one is the church of what's called John Baharim, right? John in the mountains. Remember, Elizabeth lives in the hill country in Judea. Okay? And she creates this church, come back to that in one second, of John Baharim or John the Baptist. Okay, it's at the highest point inside the village itself. Okay, the church that we see today is a relatively modern church, but it's built, it incorporates some of the remains of a Crusader church and of a Byzantine church. Okay, there's layers upon layers, and the original church of Helena is here as well. But let's go back here for a second. The Franciscans are the ones who come and reestablish the church. Remember our timeline, right? Christian Byzantines come, they build the church, the Muslims throw them out, the Crusaders throw out the Muslims, the Muslims throw out the Crusaders. In the 17th century, the Franciscans are allowed to come back to Ein Karim as well as to some other places, and they reestablish the church. Now, what's important to understand about the Franciscans is two things. First of all, they call themselves the Custodia Terra Sancta, the custodians of the Holy Land. Okay? They set themselves the task, they are established during the Crusades, they set themselves the task of defending the holy places of the land of Israel. And so they set up churches, but also just to protect the sites. And they were really known as the people that you would come to if you were going on a pilgrimage to the land. They had hostels where you could stay. So they were the custodians, but they also, once archaeology really begins, they also are very interested in archaeology. They're scholars and they're archaeologists, and they dig in a lot of places, mostly places that have some Christian significance, right? And that's going to connect to our story here. So the story of archaeology in the land of Israel rarely is because people say, oh, I want to dig here. Mostly it's because things happen. Roads need to be built. Houses need to be built, right? And stuff is wrecked, and then archaeology comes along. And that's the story in Ein Karim. In World War II, the beginning of World War II, the British, of course, are in the land of Israel. They are very concerned about the Nazi advance across North Africa, right? And that they're going to come to the land of Israel. And they do all sorts of things to prepare for that. And one of the things they do is station tanks at significant points. Ein Karim is at the western edge, the entrance to Jerusalem. And they come to the Church of John Baharim. And you can see here, there's a nice big courtyard there. And they say, we need to put tanks here in the courtyard because it's a defensive measure. And when the British Army comes and says, we need to put tanks, you agree. You say, okay, put the tanks. They put the tanks. Fortunately, the Nazis never arrive. Rommel is defeated at El Alamein, and the British take the tanks and move them somewhere else. But when you have large, heavy tanks in a nice old courtyard, it kind of rips up the courtyard. So what the Franciscans decided to do was, under the leadership of the chief archaeologist there, Father Soller, they were going to excavate. Because it's ripped up anyway, why don't we excavate it before we rebuild? And they found all sorts of interesting things, including this Venus, okay, which is called a modest Venus. You can see her other arm is missing, but it was clearly resting over here, right, covering up her private parts. And this gives you an idea that this was a holy place to the pagans before Empress Helena comes along and makes a church here. But Father Soller writes a report about what he's discovered. And he says, we found this, the Venus, we found the remains of the older churches. And if you go today to the courtyard, you can see there are the remains, the mosaics from the Byzantine church, right? All kinds of interesting things that you can find there. But in his report, he writes that there's something that I discovered and I don't understand what it is. Clearly, it's plastered. So clearly, it's a water installation. But unlike a cistern, it's pretty shallow, and it has these wide steps going down to it. And I don't understand what it is. Okay, now he's writing this in the 1940s. Okay, 50 years later, along comes a young researcher named Tamar Hayardeni, and she's writing a book about Ein Karim, and she reads Father Soller's report, and she has the aha moment that I'm guessing a lot of you had when I described it, which is, this is not a cistern, this is a mikvah, right? What's a water installation with steps that's shallow? Obviously, this is a mikvah. This is a Second Temple period mikvah. Father Soller, who lived in the 40s and was a Franciscan priest, did not know anything about mikvahs. Today, priests would know in the land of Israel, at least, because we've discovered so many of them. But in the 40s, they had not discovered them. And what did he know about mikvahs and tahara? But the irony is, and she asked to see it, and she went down and she photographed it. It was closed off, but you can still have some access to it. And the irony is, here's a Second Temple period mikvah in the courtyard of the church of John the Baptist, right? What's John the Baptist famous for? He's famous for baptizing. What's baptizing? Baptizing is mikvah. Hey, that's what it is. So it's really just a beautiful connection, but I always feel bad for Father Soller, because he would have probably been very happy to know that. But this is the mikvah. Is it John the Baptist mikvah? No, there are mikvot all over in Second Temple times, but it is a nice connection. Okay, we already said the Franciscans come back. This is the insignia on the church. They bring back, not only do they reestablish the churches, okay, but they also add a school, and they bring in four Arab Christian families from Bethlehem, this is in the 17th century, to settle. So it's not just the churches, but there are actually people living there, and these become kind of the aristocracy of Ein Karim. One of the families is the Rock family, they had a famous woodworker that came from there, okay. Meanwhile, other groups start to come and to settle in Ein Karim, other Christian groups. One of them is the Sisters of Zion. And Sisters of Zion might be familiar to people. We mentioned them when we did the last course. We talked about the Muslim Quarter. So there are Sisters of Zion. There's a convent in the Muslim Quarter. There's also a very important Ratisbon Monastery, which is the male side of the Sisters of Zion in Rehavia. Okay. Who are the Sisters of Zion? They were founded by somebody named Alphonse Ratisbon, who was a French Jew who converted to Christianity. And he founded this mission of nuns and of monks in the Old City, in Rehavia and in Ein Karim. And he eventually moved to the convent. He lived near the convent in Ein Karim, and he's buried in the garden there. I didn't remember if I brought this picture, so I didn't, but I'll tell you the story. Now, the Ratisbon Monastery was well known for attracting Jewish converts. I don't know if it was a feeling of like being a little bit at home. They were clearly drawn to Christianity, but you wanted to be with people who were like you. The Sisters of Zion in the Muslim Quarter is famous for having in their basement part of the pool, the Herodian Struthian pool. But the other thing about the Sisters of Zion and the Ratisbon Monastery in Rehavia, which is very much to their merit, is that in the spring of 1948, when the residents of Kfar Etzion decided that they could not keep the mothers and the children anymore in Kibbutz Kfar Etzion and in Gush Etzion in general, because it was too dangerous. There was too much war going on, and they decided to evacuate the mothers and the children. They had nowhere to go. The Ratisbon Monastery in Rehavia took them in until they could find another place to stay. So that, I think, is definitely to their merit. Okay, across to the south of Ein Kerem is a mountain called Mount Ora, Har Ora. The Muslims call it Ras Arab, the mountain of God. Okay? It's the valley, the Sorek Valley is in between, and this is Mount Ora across. It's a very strategic position that was used by many different people who wanted to occupy the city. In the 1830s, Ibrahim Pasha, the Egyptian conqueror who takes Jerusalem for 9 years, he uses it as a lookout point. The Turks put cannons up there to stop the British. In 1948, the Arabs use it to try to defend Ein Kerem, and eventually it becomes a Haganah outpost and then a Tzahal army base. Okay. On Har Ora, you have a bunch of interesting institutions. One is Russian, the Russian complex that's called Muscovia or Gorny. Okay. You have one of the most visible things. I don't know if it's in this picture. Not really. Maybe we'll have it in one of our pictures at the end. When you come to Ein Kerem, you can see there's like these bright gold onions, right, which tell you this is a Russian church. There's a whole Russian compound on Har Ora with nuns, as you can see. Okay? The Greek Orthodox are not on Har Ora, but they're also important. The church on Har Ora, the Russian church, has a convent. It has silent nuns. They take a vow of silence, but there is a story, which is maybe a true story or maybe it's an urban legend, when the first Jewish immigrants are brought to Ein Kerem in the late 40s and the early 50s, they don't want to get off the bus because they say, you promise us we're going to Jerusalem. This is not Jerusalem, right? We'll see in a few minutes what Ein Kerem looked like in 1948. There was no infrastructure, there was no water, there was nothing. And they didn't want to get off the bus. And the story goes that one of the nuns named Elizabeth, an old nun, she came up to them and she started to berate them. She said, you're so ungrateful. Your soldiers fought to free this place for you, and you have homes and you have a good climate and you have water, and you aren't worthy of this place. And they're shamed into getting off the bus by the nun Elizabeth. So whether it's a true story or not, it's a good story. Up the hill on the side of Mount Ora is the Church of the Visitation. Okay? It's another one of these churches that was originally established by Helena, a Byzantine church, then destroyed. The Crusaders rebuilt it. It's destroyed. Franciscans rebuilt it. And today there's a modern church there designed by the Italian architect Antonio Barluzzi. Like a lot of churches, including John the Baptist, it has what you can see here on the right, all of these tiles. You can't see it in the picture, but if you go, you will note that this is what they do, is they take a prayer or a verse or a passage from the New Testament, usually from the Testament, and they write it in as many languages as possible. Now, this is a prayer called the Magnificat prayer that Mary says when she finds out that she's, you know, having this holy baby. The idea is you write it in as many languages as possible to show that Christianity is a universal religion, right? Another unusual story about this church, there was the frescoes in the church were made by an Italian artist named Vagani. Mordechai Ardon, whose painting of Inkarn we're going to see at the end of the Zoom. He's more famous for creating the beautiful, beautiful stained glass windows in the National Library in Givat Ram. But when he was a very young artist, he heard about this Italian artist, Vagani, and he wanted to come and kind of apprentice with him because he knew that he was very good. And he came and he asked his permission. Fine. He starts to work with him. And then the word came down from the Vatican that, no Jews are allowed to work in the church, and Ardon was kicked out. He became a good artist nonetheless. Up on Har Ora, on Mount Ora, we have another interesting site. This is the home, the summer home of somebody named Bishop Gobat. Bishop Gobat was the Protestant British, the Protestant Bishop of Jerusalem. In the 19th century, he increased the Protestant presence in Jerusalem a lot. He had a school on Mount Zion, which today is called the American School. He makes himself a nice summer home in Inkarim. This house is going to be bought by the next character we're going to hear about in a minute, Miss Carey. And in the 1940s, it becomes a British cafe and eventually a mental asylum. And today it's a home for Messianic Jews. So lots of different unusual things in and around Inkarim. The person who takes over Bishop Gobat's house is this woman. Her name is Miss Alice May Carey. She was a British Christian who comes to Jerusalem in the 1930s, and she has this vision that she is going to bring world peace, and she's going to unite all the different religions. And she moves into Bishop Gobat's house. He is long dead. And she raises funds to build this building, which is still up on Har Ora today. It's the Temple of Peace. And the idea is that it's going to bring all of these different kinds of people together. It doesn't really work. She eventually goes back to England. She goes a little bit crazy. Her house, as we said, is taken over by the British soldiers who have a cafe there. And every day at 5 o'clock, they would make time for her custom, which was to pour out a cup of tea for Jesus. So rather unusual woman. But the building is still standing, not used anymore as the house of the Temple of Peace. But this was her vision, a different kind of a vision, and much more of a practical vision, was the vision of the nun Claire Burns. I have no pictures of her. There are no pictures of her that I could find on the internet. But if you go to Inkarim today, there's actually a beautiful project that's being done in various neighborhoods around Jerusalem. Inkarim is one of them. It's called Our Women, or Women Like Us, Nashim Mishelanu. When we talk about Musrara next week, we'll mention this, where it's a ceramic design, a ceramic tiles that are put up in various neighborhoods that highlight women, famous or not, that are connected to the neighborhood. So Claire Burns is one of the ones. Next time I go to Inkarim, I'll take a picture of it and put it into the Zoom. Who was Claire Burns? So she was a French nun. In the 1950s, she realized that people who had severely disabled children had no resources to deal with them. And really the idea that you had all kinds of resources for autistic or Down syndrome or all kinds of physical disabilities is relatively recent, right? Shalva was started less than 30 years ago. All the amazing organizations that exist in Israel, Alin and Ilan and all different kinds of places like this are very new. And there was nothing in the 50s. And what she noticed was that people couldn't take these babies home. They didn't know what to do with them, and they would abandon them in the hospital, as horrible as that sounds. And she decided to create an institution for these severely disabled children of all religions, Jews, Christians, Muslims. The staff was also of all religions, and she established it on Mount Ora. And it was called St. Vincent's. She won the Israel Prize. And today there are many institutions, and St. Vincent's is really mostly for Arab kids because there are fewer Arab institutions. But she was a pioneering woman in this field of providing services to a population that had nothing. So she really is an amazing woman. Let's get back to our historical story. 1929, Arab riots all over the land of Israel. The Jews, the few Jews who have been living in Ankarim, pick up and leave. But Ankarim flourishes. And by the 1940s, you have more than 3,000 people living in this small village. It still doesn't have much infrastructure, but it's very much a farming village. But you have 3,000 people, about two-thirds of them are Muslims. A lot of people come to visit. There are tourists who are there. There are pilgrims, Christian pilgrims. There are British soldiers who come. It's a very cosmopolitan, very, very busy place. The spring, which, of course, has this association with Christianity, but you can see that it has a mosque built over it. The house of the Mukhtar, the leader of the town, is right next door today. That's been turned into the Targ Music Center, right? But this is the center of the town at the time. And then what happens in 1948, okay? In April of 1948, you have an attack on a village that's only a few kilometers away. It's called Deir Yassin. And Deir Yassin is very controversial what actually happens there, the Irgun attack. And the stories of was there a massacre, wasn't there a massacre? It's a very controversial story, but what's important about the story is not, the facts are important, but what's important is the rumors that spread about Deir Yassin, because basically the Arabs said there's this terrible massacre and the Jews are coming after us and it's a huge disaster. And the hope was that these rumors would push the Arabs to fight harder, but it actually boomeranged. And what happened was the Arabs picked up and fled from places that were near Deir Yassin from fear of the Jews. And there was a real ripple effect. And Ankarim, after April of 1948, the Arabs evacuated the women and children. By the time Tzahal, the IDF, shows up on July 11th, the residents fled. Right. The residents run away the night before, and the village is emptied out, of Muslims. Only three old Arab sisters stay. The Christians, the nuns and the monks stay on in the churches, but the Muslim population leaves, and we have this influx of immigrants. In this picture over here on the right, you can see that you have the Beit Knesset HaMerkazi, right? The central synagogue of Ankarim. And there were all kinds of Jews that were brought into Ankarim and all different kinds of synagogues. There was a tradition, by the way, that the monks and the nuns would come to synagogue for a kol nidre and Yom Kippur, which is fascinating. Okay. What happens? Who comes in, right? What's going on in the village? What happens in 1948? Is, like we said, you have this huge influx of immigration. Where are people going to go? In the beginning, they move into the neighborhoods that had been Arab neighborhoods and that were abandoned, that the Arabs ran away from, whether they were neighborhoods in towns, like in Jerusalem, places like Katamon and Baqa, right? The Arabs, by the way, move into Jewish neighborhoods, like the Jewish quarter in the old city. Sometimes they're entire cities, like Lud and Ramla, okay? So the new immigrants are brought here and they're basically dumped here, right? There's no infrastructure. There's electricity, water, nothing, right? No decent roads. They don't want to be here. The ones who stick it out and move into the abandoned houses and do some kind of renovation end up having very, very valuable property, but the beginnings are not easy at all. One of the people who comes to Ankarim is Rachel Yanait Ben Tzvi. Rachel Yanait Ben Tzvi is a fascinating person. She is known as the wife of Yitzhak Ben Tzvi, who was the second president of Israel. Here they are as a young couple, but she's much more than that. They were both incredible people. They were a real power couple. She and he were both very, very fiery Zionists as well as socialists. They fought to create the Jewish state. They did many, many different fascinating things. She actually originally came to Ankarim as a young woman in 1909. And she dreamed that it would be a farming village, a Jewish farming village. In 1949, she creates the youth village, the Kfar HaNoar in Ankarim. Who's it meant for, right? The idea is you have all these kids, particularly survivors, but not only, right, who are orphans or who have very dysfunctional families, and they need to learn life skills and they need to become citizens of this very new country. And the first group is 250 children from 20 different countries. Imagine the languages. Okay. She comes and she has two volunteers to help her. She has a boy who speaks Hebrew, but he's blind. And she has a girl who can see, but she's American and doesn't know any Hebrew. And despite these incredible obstacles, she starts this youth village and she basically gives them life, right? She teaches them how to live. One of the outstanding graduates of this youth village is a novelist named Aaron Appelfeld, right? But she takes these very broken children and she teaches them how to be functioning people in the world. In 1952, 3 years afterwards, the school moves out of Ein Karim to Beit Zayit. Meanwhile, she becomes the first lady. Her husband becomes the president. So the school is taken over by others, but she's the one who starts it. Okay, a few stories from Ein Karim, just because it's got a lot of great stories. And this is such a beautiful scene. Okay. One of the houses in Ein Karim is today a hotel. It's called the Allegra Hotel, and it's named for a woman whose name was Allegra Blue. Allegra Blue was a Jewish woman, not just a Jewish woman, but a Samach Tet, Sfaradi Tahor, meaning there were Spanish Jews who came from Spain, who traced their lineage back to the expulsion from Spain, and they would sign their name Samach Tet, Sfaradi Tahor, like they were very, very proud of their lineage. She met and fell in love with a Christian Arab named Jabra Rahil from Ein Karim. And they met and they fell in love and they got married in, of all years, 1929, right? The year of the Arab riots. She goes with him to Beit Lechem to convert to Christianity, and then she comes back to Ein Karim. She, of course, is completely disowned by her family. They sit Shiva over her. They will have nothing to do with her. She comes back to Ein Karim as a Christian Arab woman. Her husband, Jabra Rahil, who had made a nice amount of money as a butcher. He sold meat to the British Army. He builds her a beautiful house, which till the end of her days is known as the House of the Jewess, Beit HaYehudia, right? She converts, she comes, she lives there. She looks like an Arab woman, but she's always known as the Jewess. She has kids. She looks like an Arab in every way. In 1945, her father dies and she goes to the Shiva because she wants to reconnect with her family. They refuse to allow her in. So it's a very, at least I think, a tragic story. The hotel has branded it as this very romantic story, and they talk all about couples. Okay, not so much my cup of tea. Another story that's a very famous story in Ein Karim is that one of the houses that was abandoned was turned into the local makolet, right? The local store. You had to have some kind of a store. It was owned by a guy named Marciano. And every once in a while, the three Arab sisters who had stayed on in Ein Karim, they would come to the store and they would say, you know, Marciano, this store, this is post-1948, of course, this store used to belong to Dr. Joachim. Dr. Joachim was very rich, but he was a real miser. And he hid his money in the walls of his house. You should really look for the money. And the guy who owned the makolet said, crazy ladies. He didn't pay any attention. Right? Eventually, the state of Israel comes along and says to Marciano, we need to pave a road down to Ein Karim. There's no proper road. So we're going to have to eminent domain. We're taking over your store. We're going to knock it down to pave the road. They knock it down. Guess what they find inside? Sacks of gold in the wall. Dr. Joachim's treasure was there. Okay, today Ein Karim has evolved, changed in many ways. In the 1950s, after the government dumped all these immigrants there, they wanted to throw some of them out and make it a nature reserve. The immigrants who didn't want to come now didn't want to leave. Right? Then they brought in artists and there was an artist colony, right? So today there's a real mix of people in Ein Karim. You still have the people who stuck it out from the 40s and 50s and took over houses and renovated them and created something very, very beautiful. You have the Christian institutions with their residents. You have artists who have come to live there because it's a beautiful and inspirational place to be. You have religious community. You have secular community. It's really a little bit of everything. The pictures here are two of the artisans, two of the workshops. The one on the left is a woman who makes beautiful hand-painted tiles, Ruti Javilio. And the one on the right is a workshop that's called Bechefetz Kapeha. And basically what they do is they have all kinds of ancient handicrafts. You can come and you can learn how to weave and you can learn how to make baskets and you can learn about dyeing fabrics and all kinds of very cool things. Ein Karim was a place that, because of its beauty, because it's so picturesque, a lot of artists were drawn to it. These are two pictures that you have here. One on the left is Reuven Rubin, right? Very famous artist of Eretz Yisrael, drew all kinds of gorgeous landscapes. And the one on the right is Mordechai Erdon, who we mentioned before. And finally, Hadassah Ein Karim. Okay, Hadassah Ein Karim is on the hill above, right, to the southwest of Ein Karim. The story of Hadassah, of course, is that it was founded in the 1920s on Mount Scopus, right? We're going to talk about Mount Scopus, I think, in this course, or we'll do it when we continue. And it was founded there as the hospital, Hadassah Women. But of course, in 1948, when Mount Scopus remained in Israeli hands, but was cut off from the rest of the city of Jerusalem, we're going to talk about the convoy to Mount Scopus next time, and we talk about Musrara, the hospital and the university could no longer be used. The buildings were moved to kind of temporary quarters all over until finally in the 60s, Hadassah Ein Karim was founded. When it was founded here on the edge, people said, what a crazy place to put a hospital. It's all the way at the ends of the earth, right? Even today, Hadassah Ein Karim is a little bit far. But certainly in the 60s, it was the ends of the earth of Jerusalem. But it was a very, very smart idea because it meant that they had plenty of room to expand. And finally, one of the tourist attractions of Hadassah. You shouldn't have to go to Hadassah for any reason except to have a baby or to go see the very, very beautiful Chagall windows, right? Marc Chagall wanted to give a gift to the state of Israel. And in the 60s, he created these beautiful stained glass windows. Each one is about one of the tribes. They sort of connect to the blessings in the Torah. They sort of don't. You could go and have a whole lecture all about it. In 1967, one of the windows was damaged, and he had to fix it. And interestingly, you know, if you know something about synagogue, this is in the synagogue in Hadassah. If you know anything about synagogue decoration, certainly in Orthodox synagogues, there's a wide range of what's allowed, right? Do you have people? Do you have people without faces? Do you not have people, but you have animals? Do you not have animals, but you have, there's all kinds of different opinions about what to do. Chagall went with animals, but no people, right? So that's what you're seeing here. And that is Ein Karim. Let's see what questions and comments we have. Okay, let's see. No, not Ras Arab, Ras Arab, the beautiful mountain, right? The beautiful mountain, the mountain of God. Sorry, not the beautiful mountain, the mountain of God. Okay, let's go all back. Books on neighborhoods in Jerusalem. There's an amazing, beautiful book. And now there's a second one coming out by Yad Ben Tzvi that is called Yerushalayim V'chol Netivotah. The first book was translated into English. Yad Ben Tzvi, Jerusalem and its Pathways, I don't remember. Very nice, but it doesn't have all the neighborhoods. Now they're coming out with a second book. So that's I would definitely recommend that. And I will think if there's anything else. Right? Spring is a symbol of fertility. Yes. Mikvah. Somebody guessed the mikvah. Yemenites moved in. My first few weeks in Israel as a student were in Ein Karim. Someone who said he had been the rabbi in Spain. We met him in the little shul, right? There are all kinds of crazy stories in Ein Karim. Spend enough time wandering around. You will see all kinds of things. Who got the gold? I believe that the state of Israel got the gold. Dr. Joachim definitely did not get the gold, and I highly doubt that the owner of the makolah got it. Ben-Gurion said the city would grow to meet Hadassah, right? That's a beautiful idea. Okay, any other questions, comments, notes? Hadassah Hospital is still in the city of Jerusalem. Yes, definitely. It's in the city of Jerusalem. And the city did grow to meet Hadassah. You have neighborhoods that go all the way out to Hadassah. Okay, everybody, next week we will be visiting the neighborhood of Musrara, which is a very small but very beautiful and interesting neighborhood. Can I elaborate on the etymology of Ras Arab? Ras is a mountain, right? I would have to look it up. I don't know. It's supposed to mean the mountain of God. I have to say, I do not know more than that. I don't know if we have any Arabic speakers here, but if we do, speak up now. Okay. Thank you, everyone. The week after that is Purim, but next week we are on. Thanks, everyone. Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you.
Shabbat Shalom.
Shabbat Shalom.
Wow, very cool. Okay, tonight, Mark Shapiro, 8:30 p.m., 3:30 a.m. We do get a couple of people from Israel, actually, who do turn in live. 3:30 a.m. in Israel. Mark Shapiro continuing on the letters of Rav Soloveitchik, fascinating series. We have all our record classes of the week. Dr. Sokolow on the Chalutzim songs tomorrow, Rabbi Shulman, the Parsha, all the regular Shirim. I do want to announce it's not yet up on our website. It's a holiday today and we just finalized it. So we don't, but on Sunday after Rabbi Lieptag's Shir, regular Shir, Rav Amnon Bazak, Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshivat Haratzion will be giving a Shir B'Ivrit. He's spoken a few times before in Ivrit on Purim. So that will be at 12:30 Eastern, 7:30 in Israel, Bivrit, Yom Rishon HaKarov on Purim. Okay, we look forward to seeing you, as always.
Chodesh Tov.
Chodesh Tov, that's right, Rosh Chodesh this evening. And if you probably are, it's already in Israel, but here we got a few hours to wait. Misha Nichnas Adar, Marvin Besimcha, we should have much, much joy and much happiness. And please invite a friend. When I was in Yeshiva, they were right, Misha Nichnas Adar, Marvin Besimcha, Ein Simcha Ela Torah. So we have to increase our Torah learning. It depends where you are, you know, and what environment, what they will define as simcha. But for sure, Torah learning is part of our simcha. So we look forward to seeing you and learning with you. And please invite all your friends, one friend. All your friends will be hard to do, but one friend I think you can all do. So anyways, have a wonderful day, everybody. We look forward to seeing you soon. And okay, be well. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.